book or turning a page difficult or impossible. The content is copyrighted by the respective publishers. For more information, please visit us on the web at nfradiobreathing.org.
Hello, this is Evelyn, and for the next hour, I'll be reading from the August 16th issue of the New York Times Magazine on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. He was deported to a country he'd never heard of. He may never go free. As the Trump administration sends a growing number of immigrants to countries they have no connection to, some find themselves imprisoned with no way out. By Nicholas Casey. Nicholas Casey spoke to deportees imprisoned in Eswatini via a cell phone one of them obtained following a hunger strike. As he stepped out of the American military cargo plane, Roberto Mascara still couldn't tell where he was or why he had been taken there when federal immigration agents forced him onto a secret flight 30 hours earlier. It was a hot July afternoon in Texas. Now, after traveling thousands of miles, he felt a cold winter's morning in the air. He was in the kingdom of Eswatini, a tiny landlocked country in southern Africa that until recently was called Swaziland. Mascara had never heard of it. He hadn't set foot outside the U.S. since he was 12, when he arrived on a fishing boat as part of the 1980 Mariel boat lift from Cuba with his mother, a sister, and her infant daughter. As a teenager, he joined a Miami gang, and in his 20s, he took a plea deal after being charged with attempted murder for shooting a rival gangster in the leg. That would have been grounds to deport him had he been from almost any other country. But Cuba wasn't cooperating with the U.S. on deportations, so Mascara was allowed to stay, provided he checked in with the authorities each year. He built a new life for himself, becoming a specialty plumber and a born-again Christian. He married and had four daughters. Then one day in June of last year, Mascara, who is 59, went to renew his work permit at an immigration office. The appointment was usually short. Mascara had borrowed the company truck so that he could head to a job when he was done, but it didn't turn out that way. An immigration official told him that his time in America was up. With President Trump now back in office, Mascara knew these were not empty words. But if the U.S. couldn't send him to Cuba, where would he go? He was taken to the Chrome Detention Center, a notorious holding facility for deportees in Miami, then to another in El Paso, Texas, where he was confined without being able to contact lawyers for nearly 2 weeks. Soon agents told him to get ready to move again. Mascara was surprised when he was loaded onto a small luxury jet. It seemed to him more like something the singer Mark Anthony would rent, he told me. Along with him were four other detainees from, as he would later learn, Jamaica, Laos, Yemen, and Vietnam. They were transferred to a military cargo plane at a U.S. airbase in the East African nation Djibouti, and more than a day later, the five men landed in Eswatini. Before they could make sense of the situation, they were forced inside a metal cage that was fitted onto a transport truck and driven to the Metsafa Correctional Complex, Eswatini's maximum security prison. In a post on X, the Department of Homeland Security had called Mascara and the four other men depraved monsters, who were so uniquely barbaric, their home countries refused to take them back. Now they were met by dozens of guards wielding large sticks. That was more than a year ago. Mascara still sits in that same maximum security prison with nowhere to go. No charges against him, no way to appeal his predicament, no sign that he will ever be freed. Cuba has not signaled any willingness to take him, and Mascara says he has no desire to go there. Eswatini will not release him from prison, even though he served his time in the U.S. and committed no crime in Africa. I first heard about his case through Alma David, an immigration lawyer at Novo Legal Group in the U.S. who represents him. When I reached Mascara on a WhatsApp video call in early June, he had already spent 11 months behind bars. The Eswatini government refused to let me visit him or any of the others detained with him, so WhatsApp video calls were our main means of communication. As we spoke, Mascara squinted at me, In detention, he had developed glaucoma, and a doctor told Mosquera he had lost half his vision in one eye and 80% in the other. He has struggled to receive treatment for the condition. "Can I ask you a question?" Mosquera asked me. Behind him, I could see the green bars of his cell where he spends his nights and the silhouettes of some of the other prisoners. "Do you think I'll ever get out of here?" Mosquera is one of a growing number of people whom the Trump administration has put into a global administrative limbo. For more than a year, it has been offering millions of dollars, often without disclosing the payments, to foreign governments to take immigrants the U.S. was having trouble deporting to their countries of origin. This includes not only people with criminal pasts like Mosquera, but also deportees who were under court protections not to be returned to their homelands because they faced threats there. The practice of deporting someone to a so-called third country isn't new, but it used to be rare. In the past, the United States might deport someone to a place deemed safe, Canada, for instance, or to a country where they had dual citizenship. But in 2019, the first Trump administration began sending thousands of foreign nationals, including people from the Caribbean and Central America, to Mexico. In Trump's second term, the practice has vastly expanded. At least 35 countries have made deals to take deportees, a list that includes nations as far-flung as South Sudan, Ghana, Palau, Uzbekistan, and Moldova, according to Third Country Deportation Watch, a monitoring group that tracks the agreements. The deportations bring up serious legal questions that have been the subject of multiple federal lawsuits. The removals, whether they involve immigrants with criminal histories or not, often happen before deportees can argue their cases before a judge. Some of the countries selected by the Trump administration don't offer the basic legal protections to which the deportees would be entitled in the U.S., such as access to a lawyer. And because they are foreign nationals with no legal status in the countries to which they have been sent, the deportees generally remain under indefinite detention abroad, without charges and with little or no recourse in American courts. In a written statement to The Times, the Department of Homeland Security maintained that anyone who was deported received due process. These third country agreements, which ensure due process under the U.S. Constitution, are essential to the safety of our homeland and the American people. A number of the countries that have made the deals are unstable or autocratic and usually desperate for American cash. The Central African Republic is in the middle of a civil war. The Democratic Republic of Congo took 15 deportees shortly before the recent Ebola outbreak. Eswatini, which received $5.1 million in its arrangement with the Trump administration, is one of the world's last absolute monarchies. The deals first drew widespread attention when the autocratic president Nayib Bukele of El Salvador accepted a $6 million payment in March 2025 to hold some 250 Venezuelan immigrants in CICAT, his terrorism confinement center, a mega prison he had recently built to house as many as 40,000 Salvadoran gang members. The Venezuelans were later flown home, and many claimed that they were abused and tortured by their prison guards while in custody. The detention archipelago started growing last fall when the Trump administration began directing flights to Ghana and Cameroon. Human rights lawyers said that this wave of deportees was made up of immigrants seeking asylum who were protected by court orders from being returned to the countries they had fled. Some were also covered under the Convention Against Torture, a United Nations treaty to which the U.S. is a signatory, which bans the deportation of people to a country where they were tortured or could face torture. They have legal protection, which means they cannot be deported to their country of origin, and the U.S. is exploiting that protection by deporting them to other countries instead, says Bella Musselmans, director of the Global Strategic Litigation Council, a rights group that has filed multiple lawsuits in the U.S. and abroad over third country deportations. It is then enlisting those countries to detain and deport them back to their country of origin, where they face persecution, torture, and worse. This workaround, known in international law as chain refoulement, is banned under the Convention Against Torture. But some never got out. They remain in the third countries to which they are sent, stuck in a kind of purgatory, a new class of prisoner created by America's widening crackdown on immigration. Human rights lawyers I spoke to have identified at least 24 cases in which people have been in long-term detention. The 19 men imprisoned in Eswatini and another 6 or 7 in South Sudan. Some were convicted of assault and murder decades ago and had completed their sentences. Some were living in the U.S. legally, others were not. Many of the cases had additional complicating factors. Mosquera is caught in a diplomatic quagmire that began with Cuba's 1959 revolution. Others come from countries without a functioning government or with no diplomatic ties to the country where they are being detained. None of the detainees I interviewed had been allowed to collect passports or any other documents that could serve as identification before they were deported. The situation, in some respects, has come to resemble a more famous case in which the U.S. sent detainees abroad in haste, the detention center at Guantanamo Bay. In the wake of the September 11th terrorist attacks, hundreds of foreign nationals were kept out of the reach of American courts, spending years in prison without ever being charged. Alma David, who now represents some of the other deportees in Eswatini in addition to Mosquera, compared the situation of the Eswatini detainees to a legal black hole. "It's like you wake up and you're in this place and there's no way out," David said. Once Mosquera was flown out of the U.S., there were no options for challenging his detention in American courts, so David helped him find a local lawyer in Eswatini. That lawyer was blocked from seeing Mosquera for nearly a year. "People are disappearing into this no man's land," she said. "They have no connection to their new country, and they also apparently have no legal rights." Of the foreign prisons, the one in South Sudan is perhaps the most troubling. As of June, it had been months since anyone, even their lawyers, had heard from the people believed to be in detention there, men born in Laos, Vietnam, Cuba, and Myanmar. The only person I found who was allowed to visit the prisoners was an American congressional aide who went last summer to Juba, the South Sudanese capital, to investigate detentions. Even so, the aide said, U.S. embassy officials declined to accompany her to the prison. Now she is afraid for the fate of the detainees should South Sudan fall into another civil war. The Eswatini government did not respond to a list of detailed questions I sent to the Prime Minister's office about its arrangement with the U.S., but my calls with Mosquera, who had obtained a phone with the help of a friendly prison guard, offered a view of a world where medicine was scarce, power outages were commonplace, and food was purchased with money sent by relatives via Western Union to the prison warden. Among those trapped with Mosquera was Kasim Saleh Wasil, arrested by U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement agents in Detroit more than a year ago. He arrived in the U.S. from Yemen in 1977 on an immigration visa and became a permanent resident. He was convicted of second-degree murder in 1999, serving 20 years in prison. ICE said in a statement that he was one of the many public safety threats and immigration violators that our officers work to take off the streets every day. When I met Wasil, who is now 71, over WhatsApp, I saw that he had lost weight in jail and appeared gaunt. "I thought I had paid my debt to society," he said. He told me he has tried contacting diplomats from Yemen, which is ruled by dueling governments of civilians, soldiers, and rebels, but he had not heard back. Wasil, who is Muslim, told me that his worst fear is that he will die forgotten in a Christian country where he will not receive a proper burial. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the August 16th issue of the New York Times Magazine on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. On another call, I reached Juan Carlos Font Aguero, another Cuban who is 60 and has been held in Eswatini since last fall. Font told me he was released from a Florida prison in 2022 after serving a 17-year murder sentence for killing someone during a fight. He showed me paperwork that he submitted during ICE detention, which showed that he had agreed to be deported to Mexico. He was sent to Eswatini instead, a country with no Cuban embassy. Font said he was ready to return to Cuba, and one of his daughters, still in Havana, has petitioned the Cuban government to allow his return, but so far there has been only silence. I was kidnapped, pure and simple, Font said of his deportation. The only thing they didn't do was put a blindfold on my face. In its statement, the Department of Homeland Security said the administration was using every tool available to get criminal, illegal aliens out of American communities and out of our country. Our message is clear. Criminals are not welcome in the U.S. Mascara arrived in America along with thousands of other Cubans in Key West. His mother, Matilde del Peral, had been a political prisoner in Cuba, locked up for 18 months after she refused to attend meetings of the Neighborhood Communist Committee. Not long afterward, Fidel Castro, Cuba's leader, declared that anyone who didn't support his revolution was free to go, and President Jimmy Carter promised that the U.S. would welcome the refugees with an open heart and open arms. It was the beginning of an exodus of some 125,000 Cubans, including Del Peral and all but one of her eight children. The evacuation, however, was messy. Del Peral and her children initially were housed in a stadium, and like many of the other refugees, they left the matter of obtaining green cards for a later date as they struggled to start from scratch. Mascara told me that while his mother fed the family and kept a roof over their heads, she didn't understand that Miami was different from Havana, where the Castro government had all but eliminated petty crime. Roberto was never a bad boy, said his sister, Maria Victoria de Ortiz, who lives in Miami. It was the bad company that changed him, made him take another path. When Mascara was about 14, he told me, another teenager started referring to their clique of friends as the Latin Kings. The name caught on, and Mascara began to go by the nickname Power. At first, they were mostly play-acting, Mascara said, getting into fistfights and hiding from local beat cops they knew. But things changed when members of the real Latin Kings, a gang that began in the Puerto Rican community in Chicago, started to migrate to Miami. Suddenly, Mascara found himself in the middle of a turf war, which began with tit-for-tat attacks between rivals before expanding into something much worse. A raft of stabbings, shootings, and car thefts ensued, with Mascara and his friends often at the center of them. Mascara told me that in 1988 he was ambushed at a fairground by rival gang members who knocked his teeth out with a set of brass knuckles. He still has rows of gold upper and lower teeth that flash as he speaks. His gang decided to take revenge. One night in Coconut Grove, a neighborhood in Miami, they shot at a 16-year-old rival gangster who survived the attack but was wounded in his leg. Mascara, who told me openly about many crimes he committed during his gang years, insisted he was not there that night, but fearing a life in prison if he stood trial, he took a plea deal for attempted first-degree murder and received a 9-year sentence. By 1996, Mascara, then 26, had served his time. He thought he had a new life ahead of him, but as an undocumented immigrant, he was rearrested by immigration agents. Mascara was caught in what is known as administrative detention, which at the time allowed immigrants to be held indefinitely before deportation. With Cuba still refusing to take deportees from the U.S., Mosquera was held another 6 years, serving time in various prisons. A 2001 Supreme Court decision banned this practice, requiring the U.S. to release administrative detainees after 6 months if they cannot be deported. It was during that time that the most brutal aspects of the American prison system came into focus for Mosquera. In 1996, he said, he and four other Cubans demanded a meeting with immigration authorities. Instead, he said, the guards assaulted them with pepper spray and tear gas. Later that night, he told me, a guard captain arrived with a group of subordinates, one of them wielding a metal pipe. Mosquera was beaten unconscious. As Mosquera and I talked, he lifted his right thumb, which is crooked. He hasn't been able to move it since the attack, he said. Human Rights Watch, which was alerted to the assault, reported that the men did not receive medical care for more than a week after the guards bludgeoned them. Mosquera was finally released in 2002 under an agreement that would allow him to remain in the U.S. and work while maintaining regular check-ins with immigration authorities. Raised Catholic, he became a born-again Christian in prison. He also left his gang, even though others who tried to do so had been killed in retaliation, and started a family. As he spoke to me on a video call, he tilted his head back to show me the names of his daughters, Destiny, Faith, Monica, and Cynthia, tattooed across his neck and chest. But he still found his way into trouble. Around 2009, after being pulled over by a police officer while riding his motorcycle, he tried to flee, resulting in criminal charges and 3 years jail time. He told me that after his release, he was cited for two parole violations, but as time passed, he began to put all that behind him. In 2014, Mosquera took a temporary job at a Miami plumbing company. He rose from apprentice to plumber and eventually to foreman. His former boss described him to me as a man who had turned his life around. He wasn't just a hard worker, he inspired the guys around him, he said, speaking on the condition of anonymity because he employs other immigrants who could be targeted by ICE for deportation. Mosquera had never paid attention to politics, but by 2024, as Donald Trump again set his sights on the White House, Mosquera was undergoing a political awakening. He saw himself as one of the working-class Americans whom Trump, long popular in Miami's Cuban-American community, said he would defend. Mosquera often went to work with a hard hat emblazoned with a bald eagle, his former boss told me. Mosquera's sister, Dee Ortiz, told me she remembered Mosquera practically stumping for Trump. He would sit on the patio and say, Trump is going to change everything, you'll see, she said. He even told his daughter to vote for Trump. Still, as Mosquera's annual immigration date approached last summer, Dee Ortiz had a bad feeling. It was clear to her that the president's nationalist message offered no exceptions, not even for the many Florida Cubans who supported him in two victories. I told him, don't go, and he told me, no, sister, nothing is going to happen. At the maximum security prison in Eswatini, the deportees were ordered to strip so they could be examined. Mosquera knew similar treatment from his years in American prisons, but this time he was indignant. He had committed no crime, he thought. The guards ordered a 24-hour lockdown for the prisoners. No calls, no lawyers. Their food was a small piece of bread for breakfast and a bare-bones lunch and dinner. A small piece of chicken was served once a week. After the Eswatini prisoners were barred from calling their families for a month, the wardens brought a phone for the prisoners to use. Mosquera called his sister in Miami. We'd been looking for him everywhere, and then he tells us he's in Africa, she said. With the help of his niece, Mosquera made contact with David. I could see he was somebody who spent enough time in the U.S. criminal justice system to have a concept of what his rights were, and there was a process that had to be followed, David said. He was like, "You just can't do this to me." One morning, according to Mosquera, an Eswatini general visited the prison and, along with the warden, demanded that the men all sign papers that the government had prepared saying they had declined legal counsel. The prisoners refused. At one point, the guards began to blast Christian music through loudspeakers and eventually demanded that the men, including Wasil, the Yemeni Muslim, stand outside in the yard and pray as the music played. Mosquera reached a breaking point in October, he said, when a flight carrying 10 deportees arrived. People were coming in faster than they were going, and he had no answers about what would come next. I said, "Lord, what is the way out?" he told me. Mosquera told the guards he would not eat until he could see a lawyer and was told why he was being held. At first, the prison guards ignored Mosquera, treating his hunger strike as a joke. At one point, Eswatini officials claimed in a statement that he was on a voluntary religious fast. As the weeks passed, the effects of the hunger strike became agonizing for Mosquera. He recorded his condition in a handwritten diary. "The kidney pains began. My arms and right foot began to fall asleep," he wrote on day 22. "In my body, I have a headache and am very tired, a lot of dizziness." Mosquera sent me photos of his diary, and as I scrolled through the pages, I could see that he had spent much of the hunger strike writing about his 10-year-old daughter, Faith, whom he last saw a week before he was deported. Mosquera and the girl's mother are divorced. "I miss Faith so much. When we would go by you little clothes, we'd go eat at the mall at that you liked so much. We'd go to the movies," he wrote. "I felt like the happiest father in the world seeing you happy." After Mosquera had gone nearly a month without food, his lawyer David reached him through one of the prison guards' phones, urging him to stop the fast. "She said he needed to be strong if they were going to fight," Mosquera told me. Mosquera relented. "The only other option was to starve himself to death," he said. After he ended the hunger strike, the guards allowed him to purchase his own cell phone using money he had been sent by relatives. It was a small victory, but far from the one he sought. Only two deportees have managed to return to their countries of origin since arriving in Eswatini. One of them, Orville Etoria, the Jamaican man who was on Mosquera's flight, was repatriated last year. Etoria, who had been a legal resident in the U.S. since age 12, had his green card revoked by an immigration judge who ordered him deported in 2009 while he was serving a 25-year sentence for a 1996 murder. After his release in 2021, immigration officials instead allowed him to stay in the U.S. provided he made regular check-ins. It remains unclear why he was sent to Eswatini. The Jamaican government says it had not blocked his return, as the Trump administration asserted. When I called him in the town where he had settled, he told me that being deported at age 62 left him feeling disillusioned by the place that once adopted him. "This administration went for people who had changed because they want to prove it, a point that you could never change in their mind," he said. When I asked Mosquera to imagine some kind of life back in Cuba, what he conjured was grim. "I'm a loudmouth, as you can see when we speak," he said. "If I was sent to Cuba, probably they'd lock me up too, just like they did to my mother." As we continued to send messages week after week, he told me about the end of his marriage, which came about after years of acrimony. His divorce was made official 3 days before he was deported, but he had always been close to his children, especially Faith. Now he had stopped calling even her. "I need to get the hell out of here," he texted me one morning. "My life is passing." Excuse me. I asked Mosquera why he hadn't talked to his daughter. He paused for a minute and then started telling me about the day of his ICE arrest. A judge granted him joint custody of Faith, and they were about to spend their first week together, he said. She was home waiting for Mosquera when he was detained, and now she asks me, "When are you coming home?" It is the greatest pain I ever had. I've cried like a child, he told me, who have been stabbed and shot. I never cried. If I let myself think of her, I will break. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the August 16th issue of the New York Times Magazine on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. One day, Mosquera mentioned that he had begun a long-distance relationship with a woman. I asked if I could speak to this new girlfriend, and he sent me a South Florida number with the name Ivy Mercado. When I called Mercado, who works for a health care company from her home in Jupiter, Florida, she told me that she met Mosquera in the 1980s when he was dating a friend of hers. They had fallen out of touch, but when word spread that Mosquera had disappeared into ICE custody, she said, I cried like a baby and I couldn't understand why was this affecting me so hard. A mutual friend sent her Mosquera's phone number and they had a long conversation late last year. Mercado called again. She soon realized she was in love. If there was one thing that seemed to be sustaining Mosquera during his detention, it was his relationship with Mercado. Sometimes Mosquera would talk nostalgically with her about 1980s Miami. Mercado would often tell him about legal research she had done on his case. As we talked, Mercado told me that she was well aware that Mosquera's imprisonment, which brought them together, is also the thing that keeps them apart. I tell him it's God's orchestration. You know we have to believe that, she said. And he'll say, well, it brought you to me. It brought us to each other. One morning in July, my phone buzzed. I could see Mosquera had sent me several shaky videos he had just filmed from the prison courtyard. In one, there was a convoy of four vehicles, including what looked like a military truck entering the grounds. In another, 11 people filed past, some wearing white uniforms. One of them raised his fist in a gesture of resistance. A new group of prisoners had arrived, the third since Mosquera's flight last year. No Cubanos, he wrote to me. One Belize, one Jamaica, the rest from Africa. I called Mosquera, and he began handing the phone to the new arrivals. They looked nervous on the video call. Like Mosquera, they said they had not heard of Eswatini before they arrived. All of them said they had criminal records, some for violent crimes that had led to their deportations, but they had not expected to be sent to this corner of Africa. Several of them told me they were under protective judicial orders that barred them from being returned to their home countries, where they would be at risk of persecution. They now feared Eswatini would simply forward them to the places they had fled. One of them, a 64-year-old pastor from Jamaica named Junior Alves, told me a judge had barred him from being deported to his country because of threats to his family. He said he first came to the U.S. in 1982. He was arrested on various drug charges when he was a young man, he said, but he had since turned his life around. Alves handed the phone back to Mosquera. Until now, it had been months since the U.S. sent new deportees to the prison, but Mosquera was sure there would be more. The guards had been clearing more space, giving everyone new bars of soap. Now Mosquera had work to do. He needed to show the new arrivals how to get money sent from home, where they would wash their clothes, what to do when the power went out. But what everyone really wanted to know was how long Mosquera had been in Eswatini. I tell them a year, he said, and they get sick to their stomach. The Gospel According to Anthony Bourdain. Fans of the late writer and chef are cult-like in their devotion, but have they misunderstood his message? By Aaron Timms. In a recent season of Clarkson's Farm, the British TV personality and back-to-the-lander Jeremy Clarkson buys a pub in rural England. Under Clarkson's shambling yet enthusiastic guidance, the battered old boozer emerges with a new name, the Farmer's Dog, and a menu of thoughtfully updated British classics made from seasonal, locally sourced ingredients. Lancashire hot pot, gammon steak with bubble and squeak, and pressed ham with piccalilli. and then amid the abundance of signals that the farmer's dog is a serious dining destination devoted to the highest ideas of ham, comes the exclamation point. Clarkson hangs a kind of house manifesto on the wall. Eat at a local restaurant tonight. Get the cream sauce. Have a cold pint at 4 o'clock in a mostly empty bar. Go somewhere you've never been. Listen to someone you think may have nothing in common with you. Order the steak rare. Eat an oyster. Have a Negroni. Have two. Be open to a world where you may not understand or agree with the person next to you, but have a drink with them anyways. Eat slowly. Tip your server. Check in on your friends. Check in on yourself. Enjoy the ride. Appended to this passage is the name of its author, the god of dining himself, Anthony Bourdain. More than 8 years after he took his own life in a hotel in France, Bourdain is ragingly alive, and his legend, or rather his cult, only grows stronger with time. Across multiple fronts, there are the TV shows, there are the books, the anniversary editions of the books, the posthumous travel guides, the photographic anthologies and the documentaries, the memoirs of the assistants, the biographies both authorized and unauthorized, the slop anthologies collecting his vital insights into snackable form. Now comes the biopic Tony, which confers on its subject modern America's ultimate honor, the right to be known by a single name, and presents his late adulthood celebrity as the stuff of misty, almost biblical origins. If Bourdain had not tasted a freshly caught striped bass on Cape Cod in the summer of 1974, would history ever be the same? Would the 18-year-old Tony have become Anthony Bourdain, chef, writer, traveler, and eater extraordinaire? The collective rage to know this man shows no sign of abating. The dark prince of kitchen gonzo has become, for the present generation, what James Dean and Jim Morrison were in earlier times, the essence of acceptable rebellion. Virtually every place Bourdain visited and endorsed still bears the trace of his memory. Before it closed last year, Chez Francis, the most recent successor to Les Halles, the Park Avenue bistro at which Bourdain served as executive chef before he found fame with his hit 2000 memoir, Kitchen Confidential, had a small glass display case paying homage to Bourdain. At Bun Cha Hong Lin, a plexiglass cube still encloses the table and stools where Bourdain dined with Barack Obama for an episode of his CNN show's Parts Unknown. Today, visitors to this modest and now mobbed Hanoi Noodle House can marvel at the table, still set, that hosted this encounter of the high liberal mega fauna, the chopsticks that served the Bourdainian mouth, the box of tissues that brought succor to the presidential nose, the spoons that touched their lips. June 25th, the day he was born in 1956, is now Bourdain Day online, an opportunity for his acolytes to remember him with extracts from his books and shows, photos of tribute Negronis, descriptions of memorial dinners, and hand-drawn sketches of his likeness. The real power of the Bourdain cult is felt in the outpourings of his followers and imitators. It's felt in the excitement that the hit gastro-drama The Bear aired the first episode of its final season on Bourdain Day, in the perpetual recreation and celebration across social media of the Anthony Bourdain sandwich, a stack of fried mortadella and provolone on a roll that was among his most cherished meals. The phantasmal Bourdain has become mightier than the real Bourdain ever was, in part because the flesh and blood original is no longer around to take issue with the way his words and ideas are chopped and shopped throughout the culture. Death is canonizing and bastardizing at the same time. Across the internet, innumerable fan accounts reproduce Bourdain's apocryphs and injunctions over pictures of him in various settings drawn from his TV shows, his mouth forever pursed into that inscrutable squiggle. Here he is staring into the distance through a pair of sunglasses, knowing how to cook an omelet, wipe your own ass, and roll a decent joint. These are the basic life skills every self-respecting adult should master. Here he is in Paris, before a cafe table set with a baguette and a cup of milky coffee. Most of us are lucky to see Paris once in a lifetime. Please make the most of it by doing as little as possible. Walk a little. Get lost a bit. Eat. Catch a breakfast buzz. Have a nap. Try and have sex if you can, just not with a mime. Now he's topless. Now he's deep in conversation with a black man draped in tribal robes. Now he's laughing at lunch. Life is good. And then, of course, there's the chunk of text that Clarkson nailed to the wall of his pub. The cult that Bourdain has spawned is now so exotic and fertile that the quotation with which he's most often associated and memed online is not even something he said. In fact, a fan claims to have made up the passage in 2021 to sound like a classic burst of Bourdainiana, and it has spread to all corners of the internet in the years since. That Bourdain never uttered these words makes them only more interesting. In this collection of fictional commands, you can see the contours of the nascent Bourdainian cult, its constant exhortation to betterment through discovery, open-mindedness, slowing down, and hedonic self-care. Every cultural phantasm is by definition bound to float, but in the years since Bourdain's death, his legend has detached from the ordinary rules of attribution and gained an eerie kind of auto-generative velocity. This is now a cult of authenticity so powerful it does not even need to hold itself to its own defining standard, a cult that can accommodate both fact and fiction. No longer simply a mourned chef, writer, and bon vivant, Bourdain has become an ideology, though it arrives at a relatively mature stage of its subject's posthumous legend. The new biopic offers clues as to why. The film liberally adapts two chapters of Kitchen Confidential to tell the story of various awakenings, sexual, culinary, cultural, that Bourdain underwent over the course of a single summer working in the kitchen of a Provincetown restaurant in the early 70s. The story is also surreptitiously about the man he became once his kitchen days were behind him, not a slave to the line, but a sensualist of the table. Indeed, the most revealing and true-to-life scenes revolve around Bourdain's discovery of his own palate. Tony is as much about the joy of developing an appreciation for fresh seafood as it is about discovering the thrills and dangers of kitchen work. Bourdain was cool, yes, good-looking, without doubt, tall, all the medical records agree. He embodied both liberal virtue and unfiltered authenticity. He was a good guy who took the time to listen to refugees and victims of war, but he was also honest about his shortcomings as a husband and father and human. The tats, the alcoholic whiff of punk rock, the kicked addictions, and the never-defeated demons. These were all part of the package, too. I'm Anthony Bourdain. I write, I travel, I eat, and I'm hungry for more, was the line he spoke over the opening credits to every episode of his TV series, No Reservations. And in many ways, that captures the essence of his allure. Bourdain came along at a time when Americans were uniquely primed to transform food from a simple source of nourishment into a cultural totem, to make eating a marker of social and individual progress rather than a simple necessity. But there's something deeper driving Tony Mania, and the new biopic helps shed light on what that might be. People are obsessed with Bourdain because of what he became, because he managed to transition from a life of work to a life of play. This is a man, let's not forget, who spent almost three decades as a non-famous cook before he hit it big. Time and time again in his books and TV shows, Bourdain returns to the moment he finally quit his job at Les Halles to become our full-time food daddy, reveling in his new career roaming the globe in search of nothing more than food and kicks, as he described it in Medium Raw, his sequel to Kitchen Confidential, as some giant hilarious con. This couldn't last, I thought. It was surely a fluke. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the August 16th issue of the New York Times Magazine on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. And yet, it did last. He decamped definitively from the kitchen to the dining room. He overcame the bondage of labor to pursue his passion. Yes, that passion was still a job in the strict sense, but it had done none of the drudgery of work as most people experience it. Around the turn of the century, just as Kitchen Confidential was hitting the shelves, the macho chef became an archetype of rugged masculinity, and the television spectacle of white-shirted virtuosos taming the flames in their cramped and unforgiving kitchens conveyed a faintly reassuring sense that America's old vigor, its gift for production, was not completely extinguished. Bourdain was part of this foodie turn in culture, but he also spoke to a widespread anxiety over deindustrialization and the broader direction of economic life. He was a celebrity cook first and then became a celebrity eater, a textbook reskilling for the services and knowledge economy. In an era of mass layoffs and collective worry that America was not making things anymore, Bourdain offered a kind of solution. Actually, he showed us you don't need to make anything, you can just eat. But eating alone would not have been enough to cement the legend. What mattered is not that Bourdain gave up the life of work to embrace a life of pleasure, but how he did it. He consumed with style, ideas, a sense of discrimination between good and bad, worthy and unworthy. More than a simple vessel of experiences and sensations, Bourdain wielded the power of criticism. He had taste. For a society at sea, Bourdain offered, if only in our imagination, a kind of rescuing wisdom. Eat local, be open to a world where you may not agree with the person next to you. Get the cream sauce. There was empathy in these words, but they were delivered with a reassuring masculine swagger. A sinner and a saint, Bourdain married aesthetics to ethics in a way that few in popular culture had managed before, and no one has managed since. And he did it all, it seemed at least, while respecting the highest calling of the consumer economy. He enjoyed himself. Bourdain was in many ways the first food influencer of the digital age, and even spectrally he still exerts the authority of primacy. The power of his symbolic transition has only increased in the years since his death. Across Instagram and TikTok, the committed eater is now a creator, and the collapse in the distinction between consumption and production is complete. Eating has become work. There are little Bourdains everywhere. Of course, that's part of the problem. Like everything else, Bourdain's vision of the good life has now been swallowed by the infinite scroll. To succumb to the scroll is, paradoxically, the opposite of what the man himself preached. It's isolating, riskless, and hedonic. The internet's endless feed of Bourdainian ephemera and pastiche is pure kitsch, in some cases even pure fabrication. Does it matter that the high priest of adventure has been reduced to another figure in our phones, that his gospel of taste survives as more slop in the trough of online, that the discernment and style he personified are largely absent from the cult he spawned? Probably not. Like all faiths, the religion of Bourdain is about belief rather than truth. The deluded, the hypocritical, and the confused are all of the flock. Eating in the world Tony helped create is not just work. It's also a form of hope. Get the right loves the founding fathers. They might love the AI versions even more. Glenn Beck and other pundits are turning figures like George Washington into supposedly infallible podcasters. By Casey Michael Henry. Last year, Glenn Beck, the conservative commentator, was able to live out a long-standing right-wing fantasy to bring back a founding father from the dead. In a video set in what appeared to be a well-appointed podcast studio, sat George Washington across the table from Beck. This was not the George Washington of iconic portraiture, but a George Washington who could have launched a CBD supplement company on the Lex Fridman podcast. His body bulged lightly under a tight t-shirt. His hairstyle looked like a lacrosse-playing Goldman Sachs bro updating the powdered wig. This was George AI. The promise of George AI, and any AI for the technology's evangelists in truth, is truth, the irrefutable kind that lies behind the comprehension of any one individual. But any IA is the sum of its inputs. The large language model devised by Beck was apparently backed by primary sources from Beck's personal library of founding documents, which he claims is the third largest in the world. George AI also included what Beck determined are the founders' immediate influences, or what they would have supposedly read or encountered, from the Bible to Blackstone's ratio. A casual aside from Beck on one George AI video interview mentions that George can be dumbed down as necessary. George is described as a librarian of this collection, but for now he's mostly capable of producing Ken Burns-like podcasts on rather banal questions of America's founding. When Beck does ask his George AI a question on contemporary society, on what is currently the biggest problem or where we should start to fix things, George AI responds by describing what he sees as a moral failing. In George AI's estimation, today's Americans are spendthrifts, quick to abolish institutions they don't understand and skeptical of truth. The last bit is overlaid with imagery of a protest sign about trans children. This seems like a headline ripped from the opinion page on Blaze Media, part of Beck's vast portfolio, but he has claimed that his alignment with the founders is so snug he's more of a direct product of George Washington than George AI is a product of him. In early March, a few days after the first U.S. strikes against Iran, Beck posted another clip of George AI, this time setting it up as an investigation into what Washington would think about the war. In the video, Beck challenges George's original warnings against foreign entanglements, wondering if there might be the need to demonstrate strength to prevent conflict, to which George AI offers an analysis remarkably similar to Beck's framing. To highlight George's pure inspirations, Beck mentions a more than 200-year-old precursor to the conflict with Iran, Thomas Jefferson's war against radical Islamic Barbary pirates. In a time of public point scoring and performative debate, invoking the founders to rail against contemporary cultural boogeymen has become an almost reflexive move on the right. Candace Owens talks about the founders as a moral compass for Black Americans who were set free, then voluntarily chose to resubmit themselves to slavery through father absence and welfare. Ben Shapiro has invoked their originalism to oppose the legal basis for same-sex marriage. Lately, AI has supercharged this rhetorical trick. Now conservatives can invoke the gravitas of the founding fathers without having to read an actual page of their writing, bypassing all knotty particularity. It's a quick way to yank the founders from their historical contexts and turn them into time-traveling, all-powerful avatars. Take the AI-based collaboration between the Trump White House and PragerU, a conservative educational nonprofit providing pro-American content online. That initiative, called the Founders Museum, has resulted in presidential portraits linked to chintzy AI-generated videos offering heavily editorialized capsule biographies. AI John Adams, while delivering quotes about liberty's delicacy and his own principled inflexibility, parrots a line from Ben Shapiro. Facts do not care about your feelings. The unattributed citation is treated as almost incidental. The two figures part of the same continuum, past and present, merely blurring together through cheeky aside. What the creators of these founders' videos seem to want out of Adams, Jefferson, and others mirrors what many want out of the technology used to animate those figures. Both are meant to be faithful and accurate, yet infinitely pliable and surprising. Supposedly objective, yet highly personal. Concrete and fixed, yet nimbly applied to a breadth of philosophical questions. The questions can veer into the obsessively particular, as they do in the videos of a right-wing streaming video creator called @HistoryDad_AI. One clip involves Jefferson traveling to the modern-day Federal Reserve to learn why the central bank was created against his wishes. Another shows a baffled Ben Franklin learning about the loss of the gold standard and the introduction of the income tax. In both videos, the founders throw in edgy jokes, befitting the trollish podcasters they're meant to emulate. Jefferson asks a supposed Fed chair, "Which one of you made Epstein hang himself?" These videos are more outlandish than instructional, but both LLMs and the fetishization of the founding fathers reveal a craving for absolute truth, the kind that had Joe Rogan and Sam Altman discussing the possibility of a completely unbiased AI president. That is blind to context or subjective motivations. This unseen background could be the blindness of 18th century attitudes on personhood, or what leads to X's Grok bringing up white genocide in South Africa unprompted. Yet this belief in a neutral, mechanical arbitrator ignores the fact that LLMs are tissues of text as subjective as Don Quixote. And as Don Quixote, stepping beyond Shapiro, says himself in Man of La Mancha, facts are the enemy of truth. You've been listening to a reading of articles and features from the August 16th issue of the New York Times Magazine. Your reader has been Evelyn. Thank you for listening.
Coming up next in the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service, we have a reading of today's USA Today. At 2 o'clock with episode number 4 of A World Appears by Michael Pollan. Stay with us for these readings and more.